XM Sports presents
At the Races with Steve Bick.
Horse racing, handicapping,
interviews.
This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
From Lowe's Ventana Canyon Ranch, a very good Monday, race fans and symposium attendees, live from Tucson, Arizona, on the way to Tacoma, something like that.
Is that in that Johnny Cash song, I've Been Everywhere, Man?
Well, no, that's Route 66. Happy, Dick Powell, literally, I mean,
at the stroke of nine or seven, mountain time, walks in.
I was just about to say, as usual, we're the only ones in the exhibit hall here.
Always. On time.
Here comes Dick.
Well, I got the champagne room service and everything with the Mets signing Soto, so.
Oh, you're all excited.
Big night.
I thought of you, exactly. You know, that news came down. And actually, we could start with symposium news. We could start with the Mets. We could start with HKIR. We could talk. There's 17 different things to maybe discuss. I know my priority first.
I know my priority first.
Well, I left my wallet upstairs. I guess we'll each go through our priority. Go ahead. You can deliver your priority first.
My priority first, as you can see, I just switched hats.
From the Rams to the Steelers. Look at you.
So we have a match coming up.
Oh, that's true.
This weekend.
That's true.
Eagles-Steelers.
That's right.
So what needs to be decided is what they're playing for, as far as we're concerned. So think about it. By the end of the show today, we'll come up with something.
By Wednesday,
That's Wednesday. That's the end of our week.
Usually food's involved in some restaurant.
That's true. It might be a Brent's lunch.
It might be a banana cream pie.
Well, we almost had banana cream pie last night. As I continue to prove that banana cream pie is more popular. Dick, your priority is Juan Soto. There's no you got to be bouncing off the wall.
Well, HKIR and Juan Soto.
All right,
but
all right.
Soto was I thought Boris was going to drag it out even longer than he did. But they got him, and the interesting thing was when he was with the Nationals, he was with Max Scherzer. And you could see, even as a kid, he's in a dugout, he's listening to Max, stuff like that. So then I think that's made him the professional he is, being around people like that and listening to them. It's not enough to be around them. And the kid is just as talented a hitter as there is in baseball. And he'll fit right in with us. Yeah, it's a lot of money, but it's not my money, so I'm not going to sweat that part of it. It blows up the whole salary cap. You know, these tiers and luxury taxes and stuff like that. We've blown through that. And just got to surround them with some pitching, which obviously you need. And it'll be interesting. But a nice little early Christmas present for us Mets fans, who Christmas presents are few and far between.
I don't know. It's just a mind-numbing number.
15 years. And I know he's 25, 26 years old, but the there's a big downside in that contract. Now, there is a five-year opt-out, which I don't really get. But, you know, he stays healthy. He's on the field. Great. He's a throwback. He takes pitches. He makes you throw strikes. Doesn't swing at bad balls, and that shows up in the postseason, because you're not going to get good pitches to hit in the postseason. And he does, because he's so patient. So just real good.
Well, and because it's all upfront money or on-time money, we won't have to worry about Alex the Juan Soto day like we do the Bobby Bonilla day. my priority, not racing, and there's tons of great racing to discuss, and Alan Foreman, who has, I kind of predicted late last week, Alan had to scratch. It's only the third symposium he's missed in its history, 50 of them. He got very sick, and now his wife's sick. So Allen's scratch, but he might be a little raspy, but he's feeling better, and we're going to have him in about 15, 20 minutes, and there's obviously a lot to discuss. There's the Maryland stuff from late last week, but there's also this HISA lawsuit with Churchill and Naira balking at the assessment system, and what feels like an undue taxing based on purse levels, and they're not going to accept it. And so Allen will address that. I wasn't sure if it was in his ombudsman wheelhouse. Meanwhile, none of that's the priority for me. I want to talk about Dick Allen and Dave Parker getting into the Baseball Hall of Fame. And I've reached out to Alex Bregman, who enjoyed a very close relationship, the Bregmans, with the Allen family. And, of course, you know, the Allens, Hank and Dick, with very close association and involvement in racing. So there is a racing tie here. I couldn't be, along with everybody in Philadelphia and certainly in Chicago on the South Side, White Sox fans and everybody who respects what Dick Allen did in an unbelievable career. It is vile and disgusting that he had to wait, and now he's dead, so he can't even enjoy it. Hank died in May, so Hank's not here to enjoy it. It is those old school baseball writers who, you know, growing up as baseball fans, were on this pedestal, scumbags and douchebags of epic proportion, to have kept him out of the Hall of Fame so that he couldn't enjoy it during his life, and it's bittersweet isn't even appropriate, right, to discuss what this is. This was pure racism. It was bad enough, obviously, when he played and was singled out, and then, you know, for decades, it's. I mean, we appreciate it. And as for the Cobra, who I got to see play, Dave Parker, so good, so fabulous. And this morning, you probably already have seen that All-Star Game throw. The All-Star Game? Is it the All-Star Game? Throw from right field, right? Yeah. I mean, literally from the corner in right field, or wherever he was, to the plate at foot level. Dave Parker was just unbelievable.
Well, we called him Richie Allen. It was Dick Allen, sure. Richie Allen. Richie Allen was as dangerous a right-hand hitter as it was in baseball. I mean, he'd come to the bat, he'd just change everything. And he did it for a long time, and this ability to get along with writers, and now more widely, more than writers, broadcasters, things like that, just go by what's on the field, and then that's it. And yet, it gets voted on. I see the Pro Football Hall of Fame is going through their process, and that's always interesting. But at least the Pro Football Hall of Fame, they have like 40 people that meet like the day before the Super Bowl, and they public in a private meeting. But if you don't want that guy in, he's not getting in. And you get up and say why, and someone else gets up and says why he should be in. And they argued pretty good. With baseball, it's always been these, I don't know, the Dick Youngs of the world. And that's what baseball writers historically have been, and we're still paying the price.
Well, and we also, for our purposes, I mean, the Hall of Fame process in racing has changed repeatedly. And give you our Dick Allen, which was Garrett Gomez, who should have gotten in not only while he was alive, but had he gotten in while he was alive, it may have made a difference in his life. In some of his, you know, in his post-career choices, and I that one was another one that was just egregious.
Well, you have to give racing credit for doing something that other sports can't do because of the longevity and of careers here. But we induct people while they're still
golf and tennis
does too. But you know, more so in racing, it stands out more that they're introduced, you know, Hall of Famers, and many times at the peak of their career, so they still have, you know, a long time left in doing what they're doing. And so with baseball, it's a little hard.
Well, jocks.
Jocks, trainers.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I think of the jocks more than I think of the trainers, actually, for whatever reason. But you're right. Yeah, that's true.
So I found that, you know, and you could find a way in baseball, you know, if they fit after 10 years to do that and let them enjoy it while they're still alive.
Exactly.
Yeah. Or well, I don't know. You bring the point up about Dick Allen. And there you bring up Dick Allen in Hall of Fame. You probably half the people probably think he's in the Hall of Fame. Yes. You're not going to hear anybody go, how'd he get in?
Yeah.
He was just, now you guys know him from on the Phillies, obviously. So he came to L.A.
For
1 or 2 years. I don't know.
Yeah. No, he was with the Sox for.
No, man, for the Dodgers.
Oh.
He came out to L.A. 1 or 2 years. And I'll tell you what, it was in the 70s, obviously. And we would go to a game, and I'm going to say he had 25 home runs whenever he was there. And 20 of them were bullets at center field. I was telling Steve Lester, right between the two foul poles, like, whew, I mean, just rocket ships.
Yeah.
And he was just a physical specimen, and he was well loved in L.A. for the time he was there.
I just wanted to look up to see when he got in. Orlando Cepeda was another guy that they held at arm's length because oh my God, he smoked weed. it's unbelievable.
Well, before Garrett Gomez,
but he got actually. I didn't realize it. He got in '99.
Yeah, it's pretty late.
They made and
they've been retired a long time.
Well, and they had made you know, and I did not realize this. Cepeda died in June. Did you see this in the? Did you see that in the news?
June this?
Yes.
Yes.
This year, June?
Yes.
No, I did not.
Well, Hank, you know, Hank Allen, I knew it and I mentioned it in May when Hank died. You know, Dick's brother, who of course you know had. Nice horses, Northern Wolf, and oh my gosh, what's the one with one name with one word? Yeah, oh, for goodness' sake! No, I know. I'll think of it. This one really was galling, and there was a chance just a couple of years ago, while Dick was still alive, to get it, and they blew that. So I wanted to get that out today. And of course, you know, one of the great trivia questions in racing among your racing friends, put this in your back pocket for when, you know, when the time's right. Who was John Velasquez's first agent who booked mounts?
Tody Tyler.
Dick Allen.
Richie.
Did he?
Dick Allen was his first job, was his first agent before Angel.
You'd see him in the horseman's room at Aqueduct and always well-dressed and, you know.
Yeah. One of the great, I've told this story 100 times. I tried to get Dick to come on the show. And I forget who gave me his number. I'm sure I got it through Maryland or maybe through Hank, because I did talk to Hank. And so I called him and left a message on his machine. And Tina and I were going to see her son Zach's game at Cortland State. And we're driving into Cortland. And all of a sudden, the phone rings. And I look down. It says Dick Allen on the phone. And I tell you, you want to talk about making your heart pound. And I said, Tina, I got to pull over. I got to take this. And I got to talk to him for about 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. And I mean, a thrill that – and he begged off about the show. He said, "Nah, man." I said, "That's not my. I'm not really nice." He said, "I don't." But I appreciate you, you know, asking, and it was really cool. I, you know, it's one of the many numbers that you don't erase in your. I don't erase any of them. I don't. I've got. You can't imagine.
It is a. It's like a cemetery on my phone.
Right? Exactly. Turn our attention. So thank you for indulging us on our first round. And Dick, I'm gonna. Maybe we'll do it after Alan. But the HKIR was really. I actually woke up because I had the flight here yesterday, and so I got up and was able to watch the last two. You know, I obviously saw the replay of Kai Ying rising, but the romantic warrior buildup and I mean, just an unprecedented accomplishment for him. You had that voyage bubble win the mile, and Kai Ying is mentioned. But you had one upset, and Marco Botti comes to town and wins the Vaz with Gavioloto and Ocean Murphy, 24-50.
Yeah, he looked like he wanted to go longer. I wasn't sure if a mile and a half was going to be long enough for him because he's had some big races going long. But he got the trip, little slow pace. It each quarter mile was run faster than the previous one. So when they charged home, he was able to get it. He obviously liked the firm ground. Kai Ying Rizin had a lot of subtle things go wrong in his race. And you always know when the Stone Cold speed draws outside, which is Victor the winner, how's that going to affect the race? Well, it affected Kai Ying Rizin to his inside because Zach never really got him to settle, and yet he still battled, opened up, held off, 108.15, carrying 126 pounds, but in a wider trip than he's used to. So he earned his first Group 1, and he kind of did it the hard way. Japanese ran okay in the race, but some of the Japanese horses just drew bad on the weekend. Soul Rush drew bad, Stambosch drew bad, and when I look at some of the people, Steve, that we see and they do their selections, I think they're doing it before post position draw.
Probably
because they're just not even mentioning, you know, so and so is coming from post 14. Good luck. The Romantic Warrior is just he's the leading money winning horse of all time. Part of that is Winx's earnings have been devalued with the Australian dollar not being as strong as it should. So Romantic Warrior is now ahead.
Wait a minute. What was that, like after the fact they're revaluing what Winx made?
When they do it, $1 million race is like a $1 million Australian race. It's like a $600,000 race.
Right.
So they don't change it.
I'm not sure how they do it, but when
ladies
she retired,
and gentlemen, we have a correction.
She was the leader. It's
like a meter.
But he's now, Danny Shum is now going to take him to Maidan and either prep for a Maktoum Challenge race for the Dubai World Cup or go right into the Saudi Cup. Now, he has speed. I said a couple weeks ago, he won a barrier trial at 108.73. for 1,200 meters on the engine. So he handles the dirt no problem. He's fast. He's athletic. I don't think he'll have any trouble getting over mile and eighth race course like the Saudi Cup has run around one turn. So he's looking at up in the bar just on unimagined heights. And well-deserved. Last year, he kept winning every race by a nose, by a short head. This year, he's just blowing horses out, winning easily. And beat a good feeling. Then Voyage Bubble, it was kind of either him or Soul Rush. When Soul Rush drew bad, I went with Voyage Bubble. He got a nice trip and got the job done over Soul Rush. 2-1-9 shots on the night, Kai Ying Rizin and Romantic Warrior. And yet still the betting was 1.7-something billion Hong Kong. I saw it converted. It's more than a Breeders' Cup. And they had a big night, 69,000 people at the track. And they keep track of how many people came from mainland China because they have to do like a passport thing to get into Hong Kong. And they had over 5,000 mainland Chinese coming in, which the jockey club is really seriously interested about expanding that. So it was and 10,000 people at Happy Valley that day.
So to watch the simulcast.
Chat 10, you go to Happy Valley.
The overflow.
So that was pretty cool. So a huge day. It all went well, but it almost went too well because these Hong Kong horses, do you really want to ship in and run against them? They're pretty tough on their home turf. Now, they're willing to travel. Romantic Warrior won the Cox Plate in Australia. He won a Group 1 in Japan last year, and he's going to Saudi this coming year. But when you ship in there, you better have your running shoes on.
Well, and of course, we talked a little bit about James McDonald on Wednesday, and McDonald with a very nice double between the mile and the cup, and he's so it's really self, not self-deprecating, but very, very modest about, you know, about
except
his
celebration.
Well, he was, yeah,
I thought Simeon was writing. Looking back at the field, and like, hey.
Here I am. I think Nick Luck was involved in the broadcast, and Nick, to his credit, kind of summed up the Japanese year, which the coda after Breeders' Cup, Nick said point blank. So the Japanese did not have the year that they were anticipating, this was a little bit, this anum was a little bit of a comeuppance for the Japanese teams. They went into the year thinking that they were going to maraud internationally, and pretty much got turned back at every signpost.
Well, they won a lot of races, just won Group 1 races. They had a lot of seconds and thirds. Thing with the Japanese is how game they are. They will go anywhere to race against anybody under any circumstances. So this year, I think a lot of that was us. I don't think they were with that expectation. I think we have this probably exalted expectation of how well they're going to do. And they did all right, but not up to their standards, especially the previous few years.
I think they seem to do better when you least expect it, yeah. Right? And you brought up a point, Jim.
Well, but there's no least expecting anymore.
No, I know. I understand that. But it'll get there again, maybe. But they came in, like Dick said, with all this hoopla that, you know, they weren't necessarily behind it.
Right.
We picked up on it, and all of a sudden every horse that was in every race, you know, was going to be 1, 2, 3.
Going to reach for Alan, and I'm just trying to figure out how, if we should, we got 2-1 here. Well, because I want you to be able to hear it, Dick.
Okay, we'll figure something
out. Yeah, all right. Let's do that. So that's a good idea. I think we'll do it that way, Dick. I was going to say we could patch it through the sets, but I think instead this way you can hear them, and you can always pick it up that's the one. You know, we got the new equipment, and which is wonderful, the new box, but it does not have the outlets. It's only got three. I've only got three jacks, so I do an open mic, you know, to pass around when there's multiple people, and then the two sets. I think I'm gonna have to figure out a way to
wireless. Go wireless.
Well, this is wireless, but you can't. I wonder about that. Actually, you know what? That's an interesting point. That's an interesting idea. I know there is things that plug in that have the little antenna, like Uncle Ray and My Favorite Martian,
there's a throwback.
The great Ray Walston, Mr. Hand. Are you people on dope?
Mr. Hand. That pizza's for me. Yeah.
The best, Mr. Spicoli. Alan Foreman is just, this is one of the great streaks in all of conference-dom has been affected here, with Alan Foreman unable to attend the symposium for only the third time in 50 years.
Almost 50, right. I think I attended my first symposium after I had been retained by the National HBPA as their National General Counsel. And then President Ed Flynn said, by the way, have you gone out to the industry symposium in Tucson? And I didn't know anything about it. And he said, well, you're an industry leader. That's where all the industry leaders go. You need to get out there. And so I went in 1985, and it's been an amazing ride with it. And unfortunately, my grandchildren came to visit for Thanksgiving, and I picked up an upper respiratory bug, and can't travel. So here I am. It's a bummer of the highest order.
Alan,
I love the symposium.
It's Rick. Real quick. Sorry that you're not here.
I am.
And I actually thought about bringing my golf clubs again because I always think of you. But I have a question. I wrote down, it's the 50th anniversary, so you were here early on. How many people were here in that first round? I wrote a number down. I want to see how close you are.
Maybe 50. I mean, it was a very small group. It just got bigger and bigger and bigger to the extent that you were talking hundreds who would come in the span of probably within 5 years of when I first started to come. And there wasn't a track operator. And at that time, you didn't have the consolidation of racetracks that you have now. So every racetrack was independently owned. You had the heads of all of those racetracks. You had the leaders of every industry organization. You had, it was a who's who of racing, including the students who were students in the University of Arizona program. And it just was the place to be. And it was, there wasn't an industry organization that didn't conduct a meeting at the symposium. I would hold THA board meetings there. Thoroughbred Tracks of America would hold a meeting. The Jockey Club, everybody would hold a meeting there. And the exposition hall was really quite an amazing place.
I can remember when it was first here at Lowe's, because I had to give some talk here in 87, because I was president of the horse racing RTIP program at the time. But I remember the key jobs is, you know, the students put this on, and there was a big group back then, probably 40 of us, and we got the tip, the best job to do was be taxi. So when you heard that somebody was maybe coming in from a place maybe you wanted a job, you would volunteer to go to the airport and pick them up and maybe take the long way back to the hotel and try and, you know, ensue a conversation and, you know, get them to remember your name, and then you would talk to them again during the thing here. So it was a big deal, and because it didn't matter who you went to pick up, they were somebody. You're right, Alan. It was great, and it's evolved, and it got up to almost an unmanageable number at one point, and switched over to La Paloma, if you remember.
It didn't like La Paloma. They moved over there. It was not well received. Attendance started to drop, and so they brought it back to Lowe's. I hate to digress. You want to talk racing, but I could regale you with symposium stories. But the two that stick out to me the most was about, I would say, 16, 17, 18 years ago. I had been on a flight with Chris McCarron from Dallas to the symposium, and Chris is a golfer, and he knew I was a golfer. And this was a Sunday night. He said, "Do you want to play tomorrow?" And I said, "Great." And so I said, I'll call down to the golf shop and get a tee time. And Monday morning comes, and it's drizzly, raining, and Chris calls me, said, I'm just not up to it. I'm not going to play. And so I called down to the shop, and they said, look, we're going to do a shotgun around noon. Why don't you come down? Just come down to the range. We're going to send groups off. So I go down. I'm hitting balls, and the ranger comes over to me and says, I'm going to put you with this group over sitting in the carts. One guy dressed like Johnny Cash, but he's thin as a rail, dressed in black from head to toe, hair down to his shoulders. And a few other guys, I couldn't recognize them, and they teamed me up with them. And I'm riding over from the practice area to the first tee, and so I was in the cart with the guy dressed in black. And I said, are you guys out here for the racing and gaming symposium? He said, no, we're musicians. We're playing a concert. Oh, I said, well, what kind of music do you play? He said, we're the Grateful Dead. So I almost fell out of the cart. It was actually Bob Weir and Jeff Cementi, who is the keyboard player for them. He's a very good golfer, by the way. And, I can't begin to tell you what an afternoon that was. And then I guess it's been about 10, 11 years ago when they were holding the symposium at La Paloma. I didn't like La Paloma, so I stayed at Lowe's. And when I pulled into the parking lot, there were press and television cameras everywhere. And I heard a guy in the car next to me speaking French say Lance Armstrong. And I said, what the heck is that? So I called my longtime law partner, whose son at the time was head of the Lance Armstrong Foundation. I said, I'm out at Ventana in Tucson, and they're talking about Lance Armstrong. There's a lot of cameras here. He said, I'll call you right back. Let me call my son. He calls his son and says, Yeah, the U.S. Postal Team and Lance are doing a meet the greet and a presser, and they're going to train out there. They're staying in Lowe's. Why don't I hook you up with them? And so that evening, I'm with Lance Armstrong and the U.S. Postal Team. The next day, Lance was a golfer. I asked if he wanted to go play golf. He said no, they were going to ride with some of the sponsors, and they invited me to ride with them. This was just pre-Lance Armstrong scandal. So I always figure that when I'm going to Tucson for the symposium, I'm going to have something exciting that's going to happen.
those are both terrific. That's a fabulous. I think you did tell the Grateful Dead story years ago, but I had forgotten that. That is Hammer's got to love it, and and Andy Serling, the two biggest Deadheads in the industry.
Yeah, Jeff and Bob, and they're still with Dead and Company.
Yeah.
And the sad thing is, believe it or not, I was not a Deadhead. It just was not
that is sad.
My music, and so it was kind of wasted on me. They invited me to the concert. They had I went the next night, and I was their guest. And I saw Chimenti a few years ago. I didn't think he would remember me, but when I told the story, he lit up because he remembered the round. We were both very competitive golfers. We had a really nice match. And I have a very close friend whose son plays with him in kind of a casual group each week. So.
Wow, that's had you gone to the show, your career might have taken another turn.
He did go. He said,
"No, you didn't go."
I did, but look, everything in life is just you get these opportunities, but luck just plays a lot into it, and it just being in the right place at the right time. It was I always have a story to tell from a symposium. Never think not.
Well, and there's no doubt that your whole involvement in the industry is serendipitous, and going back to Genuine Risk and Codex. I mean, you're like a legal sprite.
Well, look, I won't touch that one. Let me tell you something that I could regale with. I'm going on almost 50 years now, and there are a lot of stories. They'll go with me, but there are a lot of really, really great stories as I've winded my way through the industry. It's been a lot of fun.
Well, as it happens, we've got some topics that are not so fun, and then of course one that is evolving. I think we'll wait on Heisa for the second portion. I would love Alan for you to walk through what was run down through the meeting with the Maryland Racing Commission on Tuesday last week. I basically made a couple of hints. But was expecting Sal Sinatra, everybody. But I knew we'd be together one way or the other. So let everybody understand the ramifications of the meeting on Tuesday.
So I think what you're referring to is the application by the not-for-profit for the license. And I think the second issue is the racing surface at Laurel. So let me just say, with respect to the application for the racing license, the Maryland Thoroughbred Racetrack Operating Authority, of which I'm a member, has created what's called the New Maryland Jockey Club. That is the not-for-profit entity that will take over operations at Laurel and long-term on January 1, 2025. We're in a transition period right now. The transition is from this from the Strana Group, First Racing, which still is in control of Maryland Racing for the next 2 to 3 weeks, and then it shifts to this new paradigm on January 1, and the transition between the Maryland Thoroughbred Racetrack Operating Authority and its transition into the not-for-profit. And we're having a little bit of bumps in the road. And so the authority and the authority appeared before the commission in the role of the new Maryland Jockey Club last Tuesday and sought to obtain the license. they were not prepared. There were questions that needed to be answered. that the commissioners had raised, and they did not have very good answers. And so the license application was deferred, and the commission will call an emergency meeting sometime between now and the 1st of January, and the issues that are of concern to the commission will get resolved, and the application and the license will be issued. I would have preferred that that presentation not take place last week, but it wasn't my call, and we are where we are. With respect to the racing surfaces, in the past several weeks, we've had issues with horses breaking down again. And that is not something that's been new at Laurel. And it seems to happen at that very same time of the year where we're experiencing the change in weather. We've had a very, very dry summer, fall here, little to no rain. And we went from warm to cold to warm to cold. It can be a prescription for trouble. We've seen that elsewhere. We're not the only track, I think, that's experienced that phenomenon. And so to try to be proactive, the track superintendent, Kenny Brown, and his crew sought to obtain material to improve the cushion on the racetrack. The issue was not the base. The issue was the cushion. And they added material, but given these weather changes, material wasn't adhering well. And so we had a couple of incidents where horses broke down. And in being proactive, as we have to be, we called a timeout immediately to get an assessment and as many eyes on the situation as possible. The jockeys were split as to whether or not to race or not. And ultimately, it was the jockeys' decision not to race. And we took a break, and we've been working on the material. They've been adding more material and making whatever changes are necessary. And we're watching it like a hawk. And so that's what happened here. And it's concerning. It, fortunately, we're proactive here. And we're doing the best we can under the circumstances.
And of course, on that same topic, Woodbine here at the end of their meet has undergone a very difficult stretch as well. And of course, they're dealing with with the Tapeta surface, and that continues to be kind of vexing with the meet here at the end.
Steve, I'm going to tell you the same thing. I've said it repeatedly, having been involved in the investigation of the fatalities in New York in 2011, 2012. People don't like the word climate change, but climate change is seriously affecting our business. It's affecting our racing surfaces, and it's a phenomenon that we have to adjust to, we have to deal with, and make whatever changes and modifications, because the weather is so unpredictable. And it's great that we have a lot of eyes on this, a lot of people looking at it, and we're proactive, as proactive as we're being right now.
Well,
Alan, are you talking about regional climate changes? Or are you talking about the
everywhere?
I think it's everywhere. Oh, look, everywhere. There's no question in my mind. This is over a decade ago. I was absolutely convinced, and I think my co-investigators were, when we investigated the fatalities at Aqueduct, that the unusual winter weather at Aqueduct was a major contributing factor to the breakdowns. Now, the breakdowns are multifactorial, and there were a lot of other very significant contributing factors, but the track surface was clearly a contributing factor. When you look at the fatalities at Santa Anita, there's absolutely no question at all that the unusual winter that they were experiencing in Southern California with record rains, and California's on a desert, was a major contributing factor in the lack or the inability to adjust to the change in the racing surface. When you look at Churchill, before, they were coming off a very dry winter. The track was hard. You had horses coming in, not used to the surface. And I think there are a lot of people believe that weather was a contributing factor. And then you go to Saratoga last year, not this year, and they fought, heavy rains all meet, and it affected the turf course and even the maintenance of the dirt course. And they said it in their report, there was no question that climate and weather factors were a major contributing factor to the breakdown. So, you know, it's one of the first things that you have to look at. Yeah, in addition to any other number of factors, including condition of the horse and the surface itself. But boy, you know, we're fighting climate change. We're fighting it.
Alan, back to Maryland for a couple of other follow-ups and talk about the training center site selection.
So I think that the a lot of frustration with the training center designation. I believe that decision is going to be made within the next 2 weeks and announced. We're very, very close to a decision. We have to be close to a decision. We have to get started on that portion of the project ASAP. And so there are, I think we're pretty close to it. There are some things that we have to chase down and be sure of before we go ahead, talking to the Maryland Stadium Authority, because they ultimately are responsible for the build out of that project and the costs and you know, the things that we have to look at before we make a final determination. I anticipate that's going to happen in the next 2 weeks.
Yeah, explain the importance of the training center just in all the moving pieces that are happening, why that has to happen.
Well, under the original concept plan 5 years ago, racing was supposed to be consolidated at Laurel, and Pimlico was to become essentially a commercial development zone with a new grandstand and racetracks to conduct the Preakness only. There would be no live racing at Pimlico, and everything that would be moved to Laurel and a new facility. Laurel would be essentially rebuilt. In the in the ensuing time after that concept plan was approved by the Maryland General Assembly and the financing was approved, we hit COVID, we hit inflation, and more importantly, when the Stadium Authority went in and did an assessment of the Laurel building, the grandstand building, they found it actually to be in worse shape than Pimlico, not rehabable, so to speak, and needed to be torn down. And then we ran into issues as to the location of barns, because we needed to do more barns at Laurel because we were consolidating everything there. And the project just got crippled. And there were issues with the Strana Group and a major tax issue involving Belinda Stronach. And the plan essentially froze. General Assembly came back and said, if you want to save Maryland racing for the future and you want to take advantage of this money, you better rethink your project. And so we all sat down and we came up with a new plan. It's called Pimlico Plus, where racing is actually going to be consolidated at Pimlico now and not Laurel. And the problem with that portion of the project is Pimlico is not big enough to handle consolidation. It's a much smaller piece of property than Laurel. And so in order to stable 1,400 horses, which is our current stabling down from 2,000, we need a training center. We need somewhere else for horses to train and to stable. And that has been a massive challenge that we've looked at for over a year, because you've got to find a suitable piece of property in a relatively small state that's contiguous as much as possible to Pimlico, and yet it's cost effective when we build it. So we identified 11 sites, narrowed it down to 7, narrowed it down to 4, and now we've narrowed it down to 2. And the decision on the training center will be out of the 2 that are being considered. One is Shamrock Farm, which is owned by the Rooney family. And we all know the storied Rooney family, and you know, Tom Rooney from NTRA and his family is a magnificent piece of property. It's a breeding operation that they were preparing to close. And when we became aware of it, we sought to negotiate with them to acquire the property as a training center. It's about 25 minutes from Pimlico. It's just outside of the Baltimore County line in Carroll County. It's a magnificent piece of property, but it has its challenges because it's rural. The other parcel is in Harford County, which is north of Baltimore. It's a much longer drive. It's a beautiful piece of property inside a commercial development on the Susquehanna River, as you go north towards Delaware. It is a smaller parcel than Shamrock, and it has its challenges because most of Maryland's horsemen live in the Laurel area, and to site a training center in Harford County would be an extraordinarily heavy lift for those horsemen in going back and forth training every day and then shipping horses in. So, but we've investigated both properties as to their suitability, the cost to do each one, and we're now getting very close to a final decision.
Alan, you mentioned the footprint of Old Hilltop, and one of the other elements of these discussions that emerged out of Tuesday was the realization that there's not going to be a turning of the ovals. Essentially, the ovals as they lay will remain the same.
It's a complicated issue, to say the least. You know, I was involved in, I was part of the group that proposed the original concept plan. And under that original concept plan, the track was to be rotated for a couple of reasons. One, to make the property more suitable aesthetically, number one. But number two, to allow for these commercial development sites that were going to be Pimlico on a year-round basis. And at the time, we were, I think, led to believe that it would be cost effective to do that rather than leave tracks where they're currently configured. And even when it was suggested that we not rotate the tracks, we were told that it would not result in a cost saving. So we've operated up until maybe a month or so ago under the impression that we were rotating the track. And I guess in the last month or so, those who've been looking at this project have at least suggested that the track not be rotated, that it could save money, and that the layout might be better for racing. And I have to say, there's a reason for that, and that is that when we were consolidating at Laurel, you didn't have stables at Pimlico, it was a lot easier to do that. Now that you're consolidating racing at Pimlico, you have to rethink the entire piece of property. And I think those who are looking at it believe that it will better accommodate racing on a year-round basis if you do not rotate the track than if you do so. And it might also accelerate the build-out of Pimlico and getting it ready in time, because we've got to have it done by January 1, 2028.
Yeah, because one of the things that came out, and I know T.D. Thornton had a summary of everything from the meeting, one of the things I saw that I didn't really realize was that you were going to have to acquire property from Sinai, from the hospital.
Yeah, there were complicated negotiations. The Strina Group had conveyed parcels, Pimlico parcels, to Sinai Hospital and LifeBridge during the course of their ownership of the tracks. And that is property, we look back today that, boy, if we had that, we really could have done a bang-up job. And Sinai Apps, obviously had eyes on use of those parcels, whether it's for parking or build out of a cancer center or the things that they were going to do. They've actually, because of the change in the economy and the same kinds of things that we've experienced, have been even rethinking what they want to do, and maybe they don't need as much land as they acquired. But those discussions right now are going on, and if the track is not rotated, I don't know that the parcels that were conveyed to LifeBridge are as important as they once were. I'm not involved in those negotiations. It's a part of it that I'm pretty much in the dark with.
Well, things moving forward with predictable tangential issues that will continue to be addressed. And I one thing I don't think we have talked about, Alan, is the dates, because there was real concern when that schedule got approved for next year. There was some real mumbling from people that the date was concerning to people, a kind of a paucity of dates for next year. Would the pendulum then swing in the other direction once things are done? No.
And quite frankly, I'm not quite sure why people seem all of a sudden to be surprised by it. This has been about as transparent an issue as there could be. When the determination was made that Maryland needed to go to a not-for-profit model rather than private ownership. And then when there were concerns about the staying power of Furst Racing in Maryland, that's why the authority was created, to be able to step in immediately if the Strana Group, which was asking the Maryland stakeholders for more money for their operations out of purses in the Bread Fund, when they were making some suggestions that they were going to make significant cuts to the racing calendar, and it looked like the relationship might be untenable. That's why we went to the state and asked the state to put us in a position to be able to take over racing. But the state, you know, their most important question is, okay, we turn it over to you. How are you going to make a profit when nobody else can make a profit? And the answer is, because we are going to be able to control our own destiny, and we're going to be able to conduct racing in a way that is not only more in tune with what's going on today, but is financially feasible. And in fact, when the legislature passed the legislation in the last session to allow this to move forward, they made very clear that they are not going to backstop the losses. If the not-for-profit incurs losses, that's going to come out of the hide of the horsemen and the breeders, okay? We're paying for a substantial portion of this project. And so when we were asked to advise the authority earlier, right, it was basically this time last year, of what the plan was, our suggested plan for Maryland Racing, because there were several parties who were making presentations to the authority, we said in that report, and we told the legislature subsequently, we're going to have to make significant cuts to racing days in order to be profitable here. And that may not be a bad thing, because we have too many, we're running too many days. We're running up against very intense competition in the summer, and that we need to rejigger the schedule, not only because it makes more sense and we think we can do better from a revenue standpoint, but we will be able to manage without losses. So when we appeared before the authority last December, we told them that we thought the sweet spot was probably 120, between 120 and 140 live racing days. Okay. So the word was already out. We had had conversations with horsemen, and we wanted them to know that if we take over, there's going to be a change to the racing program here. What complicated things a bit further was that when HISA came out with its assessments for 2025, Maryland was assessed an additional $1 million. And that $1 million now isn't split between the racetrack and the horsemen. Since we essentially now, the not-for-profit takeover, we have to pay 100% of that assessment. And I can, you know, $1 million is a lot of racing days. And so we will go from 157 live racing days, I think, this year, probably the number we adjusted because we closed down, as you know, a couple of weeks ago, down to about 120 between Laurel, Timonium, and Pimlico. And essentially what that means is that we're going to shut down in the summertime. We're not going to run up against Delaware, Virginia, Monmouth, Parks, Charlestown. There's just, you know, we're all fighting for the same horses. We're running the same races.
Saratoga.
Revenues are tough. You've got Saratoga running, and it makes infinite sense for us to run when we can maximize our revenues. And now, for the horsemen, they're going to have 200 live racing opportunities between going to Virginia and going to Delaware, which are relatively close. We did a circuit with Virginia back years and years ago when the DeFrancis family owned. So, you know, although we're not going to be running, horsemen are going to have opportunities. They'll be stabled here, and they can go up to Delaware. They can go to Charlestown. They can go to Parks. They can go to Virginia, and they still have opportunities to run.
Very good. Well, you set me up perfectly for a segue when you bring up the assessment. And I asked you last night if you were at liberty to discuss this. And of course, late in the week, Churchill and Naira come together in a in federal court and are basically calling the assessment program by HISA illegal. And Alan, give everybody the fine points of what's involved here.
I'll, t- I'll do the best. I can. This is really complicated, and you know, you don't want to get in the weeds with this. And I'll try to stay out of the weeds and dumb it down. First of all, I think it's important for everyone to know this is not a challenge to the constitutionality of HISA. This does not fall into the same basket as those cases that are going to the Supreme Court. This is a challenge to rules and the implementation of rules that Churchill and Naira and I think a number of others feel is inconsistent with the statute. Okay. And those challenges happen all the time. You know, it happens to racing commissions. It happens in all of business. So this is not a challenge to whether HISA should rise or fall. And I think Naira and Churchill took great pains in their filing to make clear that they are not, they support HISA, not challenging its constitutionality. They are challenging rules that have been adopted and their applicability. So with respect to the financials of HISA, HISA is required to, propose a budget for the next calendar year. They have a time limit by statute of when they must submit their budget to the Federal Trade Commission for approval. I believe it's October 1st for the next succeeding year. Okay. The budget is paid for by the costs of HISA are paid by the industry. They're paid by an assessment that is assessed to each racetrack. Okay. And, under the statute, HISA determines what that assessment is. They determine what each track's cost is. And then they ask the racing commission in that state, will you collect the money for us from all the stakeholders? And you determine how you want to spread that cost out. And I don't think there's a racing commission in the country that said that they would be willing to do it. So under the statute, if the commission is not willing to do it, then they go to the racetrack and they say, okay, here's your assessment. You have to assess it equitably among all the covered persons who race at your track, and you have to collect it from them and then pay it to us. Okay. And if the stakeholders are not happy with the assessment that you have determined, the formula, then they can appeal to us and we can take over from there and we'll determine what it is. And we can even do it to the extent that we can collect the money on a monthly basis. We can determine on a month-to-month basis and then pay it back, which I don't think is happening anywhere either. Okay, the assessment itself under the statute, and in my opinion has been very clear, is it's based on starts. That is, they calculate the total number of starts across the country, and then they apportion it based on the number of starts at your racetrack. Now, 2 years ago, when HISA first proposed to assess, they proposed, notwithstanding that the statute said per starts only, to build in a purse element to the methodology. That became very controversial. I remember I was at the symposium in 2021. I sat down with HISA staff and I said, I think your interpretation is illegal. It's not consistent with the statute and you're going to invite litigation. And their response, I said, explain to me how you can build purses into a formula that's set by statute. And they pointed to a provision of the statute which says that the cost has to be apportioned equally among all the stakeholders, equitable. And so they took the position, if we're really going to be equitable about this, we need to try to narrow the gap between the smaller states and the larger states. And by building in purses, we think that we can better make this equitable across the board. So their formula benefited Florida, Louisiana, Ohio, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and it hurt states like Kentucky, New York, Maryland, and California. The THA objected very strongly because the THA, KTA, TOBA, the Thoroughbred Owners of California, we objected very strongly in a filing with HISA that we objected to the formula as not consistent with the statute, and they rejected our argument. And so then we, in March of 2022, I believe, we made a filing with the Federal Trade Commission as they were seeking to adopt the formula. And NYRA filed a similar objection after ours and supporting ours. I don't recall if Churchill, anyone else who did, I just didn't take a look at the filings. The Federal Trade Commission rubber stamped the HISA formula. That, I mean, they didn't even pay much to our argument. And so their formula went into effect. And so what precipitated this, Churchill objected. NYRA objected when they got their assessments. They entered into an understanding in 2023 with HISA. They believe they entered into an understanding that they were only going to pay based on per starts, that they were challenging the methodology, and that ultimately when the legal question of who was right and who was wrong, would there be a true up? Okay. For some reason, I guess it was in September, HISA determined to move ahead. And where they're moving ahead is we all got, as I told you previously, Maryland got a $1 million additional assessment for 20 that has to be paid. Okay. New York got a $4 million assessment and Churchill got a $2 million assessment. And I think it was finally, in their view, time to call time out that this is becoming prohibitively expensive, that there doesn't seem to be a rein on the expenses of this new program, and it is materially affecting the finances and the economics of the, not only the tracks, but the industry itself and the impact it's having. For, you know, Maryland, for example, that's, you know, costing us racing days. You either have to adjust racing days or purses. And so by Churchill said, we're not going to pay it. And so HISA instituted an enforcement action against Churchill and against NYRA. But their enforcement action was to select three members of the HISA board who would conduct a hearing, and they could determine to essentially order the tracks to pay it. And if the tracks don't pay it, they would shut down their simulcasting. So you can imagine, you tell Churchill, you know what, guys, if you don't pay it, we're shutting down simulcasting. And, you know, you may not be able to simulcast the Kentucky Derby. Now, who in their right mind thinks that that's a good idea? Okay. And so Churchill and NYRA went to court. They were actually ordered to a hearing last Thursday, I believe it was.
Yep.
They went into federal court in Kentucky, and they challenged, number one, the assessment formula as illegal and inconsistent with the statute. And number two, they challenged HISA's enforcement power to the extent that HISA, in their view, if HISA wants to challenge the fact that the tracks aren't paying, they've got to go into federal court. They can't do it through an internal enforcement procedure that doesn't even cover this situation. So this matter is now before a federal court in Kentucky. I, you know, personally, I have a hard time seeing a Kentucky court ruling against Churchill Downs, but it tees that up, and now you have a challenge to both the assessment methodology and the manner in which HISA is enforcing its rules. I would say, with respect to the methodology, I think HISA's figured out that they probably went down the wrong road, because they have proposed for 2026 to assess based on per starts only. So that's it in a nutshell. It's very complicated, but if you dumb it down, these are challenges to the rules themselves and the actual manner in which HISA is either adopting rules or enforcing rules.
So, Alan, in that change, I'm glad you mentioned that they had planned on going back to 2026. I'd seen that. Now, if that takes place, now all of a sudden we're looking at some of the smaller type tracks that are going to be paying a lot more, right, than they pay now. Is that going to be a hint?
It's certainly conceivable. I mean, I haven't seen an analysis yet of what would happen. I do know, with respect to Maryland, New York, Kentucky, our assessments will substantially drop.
Right.
I'll tell you, the other problem is the assessment is based on the number of starts. But, for example, in 2025, Maryland's going to reduce its starts by, you know, 30%, 20, 25, 30%. And yet that isn't taken into consideration. So we're going to be paying for less days based upon a previous formula. And that really is going to hurt us. Ultimately, I think there'll be a true up and we'll get a reduction. but it really is painful at the front end.
Yeah, well, it just makes sense. They got a number to get to, and if some of the bigger tracks are paying less, obviously the littler, the smaller tracks that run, you know, year round, are going to have to pony up a little more. And that was, you know, some of the concerns that I've heard people talk about, right, how that's going to happen.
Remember, the formula benefits states with a large number of racing days and smaller purses. Okay. And that, I think Churchill and I were arguing, is an upside down situation. So if you really want to level it across the board, you do it based on per starts. And that's why it was built into the statute. I don't know how much those who were responsible for putting the HISA statute together really gave to how we're going to pay for this thing. Because I know in the years of discussions pre-HISA about creating some kind of a national authority to oversee anti-doping and to mandate safety rules, every time you got to the discussion of how much money do you need and how are you going to pay for it, everybody looked like deer in the headlights. And so we end up with this formula, and now this formula is it's been a minefield of litigation.
How do you anticipate? Will this be? Is this something that's negotiable out of court?
I think so. I think they're going to have to figure it out. Yeah, I think they need to figure it out. They need to resolve it. They need to resolve it sooner rather than later. And I suspect part and parcel of that is that, you know, Churchill and Ivor have complained that while HISA's budget continues to increase, the costs to the industry are substantially increasing. And I think that there probably will be a closer look at, I think the budget in 2023, HISA budget was $66.5 million. And is that, you know, do we need that kind of money to run this program? I'm not taking a position one way or the other. That's, you know, not something I've looked at, but I know that's what the concerns are. You get to a point where, you know, you're going to have people say, I can't afford this. You know, you're impacting our programs. The HISA argument is, look, this industry needs a safety program. It needs an anti-doping program for its survival. And I don't think anybody disputes that. The question is, what is the cost to do that? And they have some very ambitious plans on data gathering, because the industry's never done that. Enhancements to the safety program. Unfortunately, we've been consumed in litigation since day one. That's been very expensive to the industry. A lot of that will hopefully be done with a year from now. The Supreme Court is meeting, I think, January 10th to consider the three appeals before them to the HISA statute's constitutionality. They will decide which of the three, or maybe all three, and consolidate them and determine what issues they want to hear argued. So I'm kind of hopeful that they'll schedule it for argument, and we'll have a decision in June.
You know, once we get through this, and once you guys get settled there in Maryland, I know you're working out some plans with Colonial. Is there maybe talk to go back to the table again with the parks and, you know, Delaware, Monmouth, and you guys and Colonial to work out some kind of a schedule system? You know, bring back the match series, but more, you know, scheduling, vanning, just a schedule where everybody works together, and maybe even have a central racing office where, you know, horses are shared and everything's, would work in a rhythmical fashion. It's been a dream long time, as you know, and you know, maybe the next few years is a time to start something like that.
Well, look, it works now because the not-for-profit, the Maryland stakeholders are taking over in Maryland. So you don't have a third-party operator who has their own interests at heart. Right? Remember, one of the problems with MATCH, one of the problems with any kind of regional cooperation is each of these tracks is separately owned by a company that has its own views on how to maximize its revenues. So they don't necessarily care about Maryland or Virginia or, you know, and it's the same mindset. And I don't know if you ever sat in the MATCH meetings, but it was very difficult to navigate through you know, well, look, this is when we run our stakes. You can't run this race on top of ours because we have a big race. I mean, to try to get them to massage racing schedules was extraordinarily difficult. And pulling us out of the summer makes it a little bit easier. But we had talked to Delaware. Our schedule dovetails very well with Delaware. It dovetails very well with Virginia. So you essentially have a circuit between Maryland, Delaware, Virginia. When we talked to Parks and we talked to Monmouth, it was, you know, Monmouth runs in the summertime. What adjustments can Monmouth make?
Right.
Okay. Better that they do a circuit or have some understanding with Parks. You know, Parks closes down for a period of time, but, you know, trying to get the horsemen who are willing to run less racing days is very difficult. And then you when you start dealing with New York, that's a whole nother ballgame. I mean, you're not going to get any changes. Saratoga dominates the summer, although it helps everyone from a simulcasting standpoint and brings people out to the racetrack. But it's hard to do. Could there be a central racing office? Potentially. But, you know, our business is operated by independent operators. Right. It's very difficult to get them to act cohesively. Trust me, I know it. I lived it for how many years doing the mats here.
I know. Well, when we got that thing started, I know it was pounded out, but there was cooperation, and in the end, it worked out. And, you know, everybody has to give a little bit for this stuff to work, and I know I know the answers to some of these questions I'm asking, but I just wanted to, you know, get it out there to get it back on the table again. And I know we had talks, many talks, about, you know, hey, you shut down for a while, keep the backside open. You know, you can use our horses, or even the state bred programs, you know, writing races to where they're not just limited to one state, maybe, you know, limited to open that up a little bit. All kinds of things. You know, at where we are now, we need to open up that idea drawer and, you know, expand a little bit.
Well, hopefully we can be the catalyst for it. I mean, one thing that will happen here is that we're going to allow monies from the bread fund and the purse account, to the extent that they're paying bonuses to owners or breeders, that if we shut down and our horsemen have to go to Virginia or Delaware, that we'll pay those bonuses in races that they run out of state, so that we're not penalizing our owners and we're not penalizing our breeders. If you cut the racing program down too far, you could be at a tipping point with a very challenged breeding industry. So we have to look at all aspects of the business here.
No, and that
make sure that everybody's covered.
Well, that's what you're doing there, as far as, you know, still paying the breeders no matter where they run is a great idea.
Yeah.
You have to
and
keep that.
You go to the Mid-Atlantic Sales. Hey, you're going to have brand new facilities in Maryland. You know, we're going to become, you know, hopefully very dynamic. And at the same time, because we have to adjust our schedule, you'll be able to collect bonus money even when Maryland's closed. And I think that will help to stimulate people who would, you know, buy a Maryland bread. That's the whole point.
Yeah. So in other words, the breeding reward circuit is still year round. Even though the racing is
still year round, yes. Now we've got to figure out: is it just going to be limited to Delaware and Virginia, which I think it will be? But that's enough, because that's, you know, when we close, we're essentially closing July, August, and that's a time when these horses run out of state that they'll be able to continue to earn bonus money.
Alan Foreman joining us. We wish he was sitting right across from us, as he has for many years when we have these discussions at From Symposium. And Alan, a broader HISA topic, obviously, you know, facing, you know, the legal challenge, which is now, you know, feels like, you know, the docket is firming up and that decision will come. We talked about this assessment lawsuit from Churchill and Naira. Meanwhile, last week there was, I thought, an important extension of authority by the authority. And that was the way they acted on the Paco Lopez incident at Parks. And that was obviously met with wide spread approval and appreciation. And you know, I don't know if it was. I'm sure the sincerity of you know, the using the provisional suspension concept was sincere. Also feels like it was a kind of a winning of hearts and minds initiative.
Well, look, it's a safety and welfare issue.
Yep.
And HISA's mandate is safety and welfare, and they preempt state racing commissions with respect to safety and welfare issues. So for them to step in entirely appropriate. You know, you want to talk about my history, you remember, I think it was in 2008, Jeremy Rose struck a horse in the eye as he was coming down the lane to the finish line. It made it very quickly to social media, and that there were, you know, it became a very serious problem for racing. I represented Jeremy in that case. And what I remember most about that case was that those of us who were involved, a number of us received death threats. And when I went to the hearing, there was more security there than there were people interested in watching the hearing. But, you know, Jeremy, from the get-go, he explained what happened. He took full responsibility. If you know, you know, my the way I do work, that's the way I operate. We tried to get to the root of the problem, and the sense was that, if number one, it was not intentional. Number two, his riding style was somewhat questionable. And number three, that what's the appropriate penalty for something like this? And so there were people calling for him to be rooted out of racing, you know, all that. So one of the things we did was we asked Chris McCarron, who was running a riding school at the time, to work with Jeremy during Jeremy's suspension and try to correct some of his riding style, his use of the crop, where his arm was in relation to the horse, because his riding style put him in peril of doing something like that. And he didn't need counseling. This was not an anger management issue at all. And he took a voluntary suspension, and that was the end of it. And McCarron reported back to the Delaware Commission that he had made substantial changes, and you never heard about it again. But it was a very, very difficult time. This one, you know, whoever was involved, I think the way they handled it was entirely appropriate. So, you know, I take my hat off. I thought HISA handled it appropriately.
Well, and going back to that, that was with the Wolfendales, with Howard and Tammy, and it, if I remember, Rose got 6 months.
He originally got 6 months. That's right. And then I appealed it on his behalf. That was the stewards, and the commission reduced it.
That was in Delaware. That was right.
Delaware. Yeah. Right. I mean, John Mooney was involved. John Mooney will tell you that, you know, he called me. He says, I just want you to know you've gotten some death threats. And I went, oh, this is fun. I've never had that happen in racing before. But it was a very emotional issue. PETA was involved. It really was very ugly. And I remember going to the hearing, being very nervous about it and seeing police cars everywhere. And I walked into a mountain of security, and then I looked around the hearing room. There weren't 10 people there who were interested in the hearing, other than media.
Huh. Well, I thought the way, you know, the way they handled it was, you know, like you say, appropriate, and it was timely, and it went a long way. Honestly, it went a long way to kind of quelling, you know, the outrage. It was very effective.
And that's what they're there for. I mean, to all the criticism that they get is that they're a very effective organization in helping to address some of racing's biggest problems. And there's still work to do with the anti-doping program. We're very engaged on that. We are making progress. I mean, I'm seeing a lot of changes and a lot of differences that, you know, are to the positive. And, you know, we just got to just continue to move forward. I think in the, you know, Lopez case, they got his attention. And I'm sure he's under a very tight rein. that if he gets out of line again, he's going to it's going to be a different result.
Well, Alan, as always, comprehensive and succinct and informative, and we're grateful as always.
And it sounds like you got better towards the end of the call, Alan. You might be up.
No, today I have my voice back. Steve called me Friday, and I said, Steve, I can't even talk. I can't breathe, let alone talk. And the doctor said, you know, you can't travel. Randy and I are celebrating our 50th wedding anniversary next week.
Wow.
And we were going to go to Vegas on the way to Tucson because we wanted to see the Eagles at the Sphere. That's really what I was looking forward to. I had to cancel out of that one too. That was a tough one too.
Well, let me just tell you, just so you know, next March, April, and May, Dead and Company are back, so you can go back and see Bob and Jeff.
I got a call actually on Saturday that when it was announced and said, hey, you want to go out there and see the Dead? And I said, only if I can get backstage and talk to them about golf. So.
Well, you make sure you call me when that happens, please.
But no, I can't tell you how sad I am that I'm not out there. And to see everybody, to me, it's an opportunity just to see everybody, sit down and chat, catch up and network. And a lot of people who come out for business, you know, they want to sit down and talk to you and get a sense of what's going on. So it's a real lost opportunity for me. And I just, you know, it's sad that I can't do it. Just physically can't do it.
No, it happens. I missed one, I don't know, four or five. I missed one in the last 10 years or so. So I know the because of something I forgot. I don't even remember what happened. Alan, thank you. And mazel tov on 50 years of marriage. And I'm trying to think on the next industry fund. I guess Eclipse Award week, right?
I will be at Eclipse Awards for sure. I definitely will be there. So we'd love to get back together again.
Outstanding. And, well, there may be, actually, there might be, you know, late breaking news right around that time, too. So we'll look forward to it. Thanks for everything all year.
Sure. Have a great week, everybody. Thanks. Thanks, Steve.
Alan Foreman, folks. And, the various elements, there you go, Dick, the various aspects of you know, the high said, you know, they're one of the things that is, I was kind of alluding to a little bit when I mentioned the hearts and minds, and we'll talk to Lisa Lazarus, obviously, this week, too. There's things that are absolutely really welcome and have shown, you know, to be helpful and a path forward for the industry. And then there's elements of this that just are the bully tactics and that are, you know, really been troubling on backstretches in terms of, you know, the way in which Hammer, you and I were talking at dinner last night, you know, the way in which you know, the veterinary community is being kind of browbeaten. I mean, there's parts of this that are just that are marks against, you know, HISA going forward, and then there's things like last week which really, you know, show how useful and how helpful it can be.
According to what Alan was saying, clearly we're going to have less racing. If we're going to have less racing, shouldn't it cost less to regulate it? If we're going to go from 4 days a week to 3 days a week, and part of the reason is to be able to pay the fees that regulate the racing that we have, that I don't think anyone really signed up for that. It just didn't seem to be on the agenda of things when HISA was being proposed. And, oh, by the way, we're probably going to see a 20% cut in race days.
Well, I don't think anybody anticipated. Well, I don't think anybody knew what that number was.
Right.
That, what did he say, 63 million?
Yeah.
I don't think if you'd have taken a poll that it would have been that high. thought about. And maybe we needed to get to this time where the pendulum in racing, that we don't you know, if the pendulum shifts a few degrees left and right, don't react. We got to wait till that pendulum gets up to that, you know, the 90 degree mark before we react. And so we might be at the time where we're coming back, and maybe common sense can, you know, rear its head again in some of these decisions and some of the rules. And you know, so we actually have I have a meeting here, a summit, where some racing people are going to sit down with some of the HISA people and some of the high woo people again, and we're going to, you know, talk about some of the situations that have worked and what hasn't worked, and we're getting some of those corners rounded a little bit where the communication has improved, and but there's a ways to go. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, it's just the lawsuit. I thought reading it was a little unnecessarily strident. I mean, they accused Heiss of fiscal mismanagement. All right, well, you got to give me an example. You just can't throw that out there without something behind it. You don't agree with the funding formula, and you're kind of right, because in 2026, it's going to be the funding formula that you thought you were going to get. So these this year, next year, the previous year, that's the issue. But it kind of went over the top with the reading the actual lawsuit. And I don't know. If we're going to have fewer racing, I would like it to be market determined, not because
reactive to exactly. To something like this.
Yes.
Well, and one of the things that I think has hurt a little bit Heiss's overall, you know, outward appearance is. It's a positive that they are reactive to things, and it's also, it kind of shows that they acknowledge that
they didn't get it right.
Exactly.
First.
Let's take the break here. Going to come back to Tucson. We're at the University of Arizona. Symposium on Racing kicks off later this afternoon. Second half at the races. Sirius XM back after this.
Specifically for horse racing. Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions. And offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action in thrill of horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo STEVE200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
Want to know a secret? The Massachusetts Breeding Program pays huge bonuses for finishing first, second, or third at any racetrack in the country. You didn't know that, did you? Massbreds get paid up to an additional 25% of their purse earnings for the owner, and breeder, and stallion owner, and developer. It's the best-kept secret in racing, till now. Tell all your friends, and to learn more, visit massbreds.com.
Whether you're new to the racing game or just looking to enhance your operation, Hermitage Farm and Goshen can help you. We are conveniently located between Churchill Downs and Keeneland Racecourse and near world-renowned equine hospitals. With spacious paddocks, expert staff, and qualified veterinarians, we offer full-service boarding, breeding, and sales preparation, as well as post-operative care and layup services. Visit us in person or online at hermitagefarm.com.
Just minutes from downtown Saratoga Springs, you'll find GMP Farm, a revolutionary state-of-the-art equine therapy and rehabilitation facility offering the most advanced equipment and knowledgeable staff to care for your equine athlete. From oxygen therapy and laser treatments to thermal imaging, dry salt room, and cryotherapy treatment, all alongside a 7/8 mile Tapita training track, GMP Farm is revolutionizing equine care. To see a full list of services and book your horse's rejuvenation session, visit gmpfarm.net today.
always consider Bleeder Shield. The leading all-natural paste used to greatly reduce or eliminate EIPH. The list of trainers who trust Bleeder Shield is endless. Shouldn't you join the team? To learn more, contact Joseph Vellante at 215-501-6880.
PA Bread, I think we've built a brand at this point.
It's excitement at every step.
Roses for Deborah just set a new track record.
On average, for the past decade, Pennsylvania paid over $28 million a year in breeders' awards, restricted races, and owner bonuses. Plus, PA Bred shine on the world's biggest stage. Just three states have bred more Breeders' Cup winners. Learn more at PABred.com.
The Remington Park Thoroughbred season is in the stretch run, heading to the final night of live racing on December 13th featuring the Springboard Mile. Racing starts at 6:30 p.m. Wednesday through Saturday. Then on Friday, December 13th, the Springboard Mile will wrap up the season as two-year-olds compete for qualifying points to next year's Kentucky Derby. The first race is at 5 p.m. on Springboard Mile night, Friday, December 13th. The Remington Park Casino always features jackpot play. Visit RemingtonPark.com for group rates, suite rentals, and more. Let your heart race at Remington Park.